It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, Politics Wednesday, and we have the good fortune today to have joining us Dennis Goldford, professor and chair of political science at Drake University in our Des Moines studio. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Ben.
Dave Anderson is with us as well in our Ames studio, assistant professor of political science at Iowa State University. Good to have you on board, Dave.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Lots to talk about a little later in the hour. I want to ask you, as we near 100 days in office for this administration, to take a bit of stock, look back on the, 85 days, something like that. We have some new developments in the news in the Russia investigations. Also, how the U.S. Senate is changing in light of that rule change that led to the confirmation of Neil Gorsuch. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. First of all, we're going to be focusing on how much a president should consult Congress when military action is at hand. Today, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson meeting with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, warning the U.S. not to attempt another attack against Syria after last week's missile strike. That followed last week's chemical weapons attack, which left more than 70 people dead in Syria, including children. Here is one of our senators at a town hall meeting in Elkader this week, Senator Joni Ernst, defending President Trump's airstrikes on a Syrian airbase, but with this caution.
So it was in direct response, one strike against the drop of the chemical agent. Anything further, if there are further actions that would happen, the president needs to come to Congress and needs to explain that.
Okay, Senator Ernst earlier this week. Let's talk a little bit about Congress and military action in a moment. But first of all, this direct action, how you interpret this, Dennis, this single strike up to now, of last week and its implications?
Well, this made people sit up and take notice of President Trump. It changed the discussion tremendously. You had cable news hosts just sort of fawning all over him and, in just reprehensible ways, just, one saying he became president today when he did this, and Brian Williams talking about how beautiful it looked with the weapons firing. So that said more in a way about how excited talking heads get about military action that they themselves were not in than anything else. But, there was always this issue of the extent to which the U.S. should do anything with regard to the Syrian conflict. And we know that President Obama said that, no, here's my red line. If you use chemical weapons, you're going to pay for it. And they did, and he didn't. And in fact, Donald Trump, of course, again, without any sense of historical memory or respect for facts, said that, this should have been done a long time ago. Well, the long time ago when President Obama was considering this, Mr. Trump implored him not to do anything, saying this was none of the U.S.'s business.
And wasn't it in 2013 that that time President Obama did turn to Congress, right, and asked for authorization?
Right, and that will get to the constitutional question you'll ask momentarily. But sure, he asked for some authorization, and especially Republicans in Congress wouldn't give this to him. Democrats weren't thrilled either, but Republicans really oppose this, whereas they're all supportive of that now with Mr. Trump. So there was a partisan cast to this as well.
Mm-hmm. Dave, as we look at this strike, I guess the big question, is this a lone strike? Is it a strategy? Do you see anything emerging there?
There's probably no long-term strategy with this. It's getting involved in Syria is kind of one of these nightmare scenarios where the only way the United States military could have a real impact would be to put soldiers on the ground, and almost nobody is in favor of that. So what we're left with is exactly what President Trump did, which is ordering a missile attack that has limited effect on taking out some hard targets. But that doesn't really shift the long-term conversation in Syria. You can't defeat Bashar al-Assad by launching missiles at him. It makes us talk about the situation more, but it really doesn't change the situation on the ground very much.
Dennis, now let's get to that bigger question of the president acting with military action anywhere in the world, any president. What does our Constitution say about that? What is the context we have in the last few decades say about that?
Sure. Well, first and foremost, the Constitution in Article 1 grants Congress the power to declare war. It does not give the president any unilateral power to declare war or do anything at all like that. And, of course, until really after World War II, we didn't have a standing army. We had next to no army prior to World War I. The Selective Service Act was passed. We had a draft. And then after World War I, there was tremendous demobilization. It was only after World War II, while there was demobilization, there was still more of a significant standing army left. So there was something for the president to use, if you will. Now, constitutionally, if there is a direct attack on the U.S. like 9/11 or like Pearl Harbor, there's no question that the president has the power under the Constitution to respond without going to Congress first. Now, our last formal declaration of war was on December 8th, 1941, when FDR gave his famous A Day That Shall Live in Infamy address to Congress after Pearl Harbor. But that was our last formal declaration of war. Presidents have committed troops in various circumstances since then, notably Korea, although supposedly under the authorization of the United Nations. But Vietnam was the big one, as I'm sure you know. And Congress, on the one hand, got concerned about the president's ability to act unilaterally with regard to troops. So they passed the War Powers Act. President Nixon vetoed it. And this is around 1973 or so, and it said if the president's going to commit troops, which seemed to suggest the president had the power to do that, in hostile areas, the president had to report to Congress and without a congressional authorization had to withdraw those troops within 60 days or with a 30-day extension up to 90 days. The problem is that no president, Republican or Democrat, has wanted to abide by this particular statute because all presidents believe that's an infringement on their powers, but nobody, literally and figuratively at this point, has wanted to make a federal case out of it yet.
Mm-hmm. The start of the Iraq War in 2003, Dave, we had Congress authorizing that, right?
Yes.
And we had Hillary Clinton on record voting for it, for instance, which Congress— Well, they don't necessarily like to be pinned down with a vote on these things, right?
No, they don't really like to be pinned down. The first war in Iraq was a really interesting one when George H.W. Bush, the first Bush, really lobbied across the world to initiate action against Iraq and pressured Congress. He lined up international funding for the war in Iraq and pressured Congress and said, well, your main power is to authorize the use of troops and to fund the use of troops, and I may be able to go around you and fund this through other nations. So really, I just need your okay. And he pressured Congress.
I think to some extent the presidents, all of these presidents, both Bushes and President Clinton with regard to Kosovo, basically said, I don't really have to do this, but I'm going to do this voluntarily to do precisely for the reasons that Dave mentioned. But I think the problem for Congress is they wanted to avoid the so-called imperial presidency, sort of make sure the president can't get us into trouble the way Kennedy and then Johnson and Nixon did in Vietnam. But they don't have the political courage to do so because the president can come back if Congress doesn't vote for as Dave said, the weaponry and the equipment and everything and support this. President can come along and say, Congress or you politicians, you're endangering American boys and girls.
Exactly.
You're endangering America by not voting for this. And there aren't many members of Congress with the intestinal and political fortitude to stand up against that kind of critique.
Mm-hmm. Join our conversation as we pursue the latest politics with Dennis Goldford and Dave Anderson, our political experts this week. 1-866-780-9100. Currently talking about how much the president can do militarily in the world and how much he has to consult with Congress. Let's go to Jim in Dubuque. He dialed 1-866-780-9100. Hi, Jim. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm wondering why everyone seems to keep downplaying this. It's just a chemical attack. It's those people, not ours. What Assad did was use, if in fact he did use sarin gas, he used a weapon of mass destruction against his own people. And if that is the case, then yes, I think President Trump was correct in doing this one attack against them to slap him down. Anything further, I'm not in favor of him unilaterally, but this needs to be made plain to Assad. You do not use a WMD, period.
Okay. Jim, good point here. Let's talk about that a little bit. We have tens of thousands, if hundreds of thousands dead in the Syrian conflict, many also women, children, non-combatants dying by conventional means, also tortured in prisons by the Assad regime, tortured to death as well. Why does this leap out at us chemically, Dave, that we have the tragedy of 70 people dying this way garners the headlines that tens or hundreds of thousands do not, perhaps?
Well, I think this goes back to World War II, and post-World War II, we had the Geneva Accords, and we agreed as a world that certain weapons were just not humane and should never be used, and included that was biological and chemical, and to a degree, nuclear weapons, that these are weapons of mass destruction, and that they are just never appropriate to be used against human beings. And this is a tough thing to talk about now, because it means that implicitly we are willing to allow regimes like Assad's to kill their own people as long as they use certain type of weapons. But when they cross that bright red line and use chemical or biological weapons, the world community has a responsibility to intervene. And that's a really difficult conversation.
Is that why we have the avoidance of weapons of mass destruction, as Jim, I think, points out there from Dubuque?
Yes, they are considered weapons of mass destruction. They are inhumane. They are never supposed to be used on a battlefield, particularly against civilians.
Mm-hmm.
But it involves a responsibility for the world community to step up and do something. And it's been very difficult to convince the world community to intervene in situations like this, because the only way to really intervene and prevent it from happening again would be to invade. And we would have to put together some kind of military force to come into a country, topple its government who used the weapons, and somehow pacify their military. And that's not easy.
Mm-hmm. An offshoot of this story here, the attack on Syria following its chemical weapons attack on its own people. Let me just read from the New York Times. A week ago, President Trump was accused of being a tool for the Russians, an unwitting agent of influence, so full of admiration that he defended President Putin against critics who called him a killer. Now, Mr. Trump is in a diplomatic clash with Mr. Putin's Russia, his administration accusing Moscow of trying to cover up a Syrian chemical weapons attack on civilians, and his Secretary of State delivering us or them ultimatums. So, Dennis, Donald Trump's dream of a new relationship with Russia seems to have vanished very quickly.
Well, you know, we've had some commentary, Lawrence O'Donnell, for example, on MSNBC, who suggests a sort of double backflip, Machiavellian kind of approach, that basically this helps establish Trump as not a tool of the Russians. From that point of view, this is simply window dressing, that basically Trump let the Russians know this is going to happen. The Russians are going to lodge their protests. But this gives Trump some distance from that charge on that more cynical view of things. At least we're seeing more criticism here. But the question will be, how does this play out?
Do you think it is window dressing?
I don't know. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was my first reaction to that. But at the same time, you heard Trump in the interview with Fox Business News saying this is bad for Russia. This is bad for the world. So he still seems to be concerned about what's good for Russia in this regard.
Mm-hmm.
It looks as though it puts us on a bit of a collision course, but let's talk about it in a week and see where we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was an interview with the Britain's Daily Mail newspaper that the president's son, Eric Trump, said, quote, "If there is anything that Syria did, it was to validate the fact that there is no Russia tie." Weigh in on that, Dave. Truth to that claim? Or is this a cynical distraction from the Russia investigations into election meddling?
Well, I think it's very early to make a determination in any way here. I think what this really reveals to us is kind of the lack of coherence of a Trump doctrine right
exactly.
now.
Exactly.
I mean, Trump was very clear throughout the campaign that his doctrine was going to be America first. We are not going to get involved in these international incidents because it was not in the interest of America. And that sounds very callous. But if you talk to Donald Trump 2 months ago or 2 years ago, he would tell you that while using weapons of mass destruction in Syria is terrible, you know, it doesn't advance America's interests to intervene, that it's a horrible atrocity. But unless some other country is going to fund our operations or agree to work with us, it just doesn't satisfy any interest of America to get involved. And suddenly that just changed overnight. We had an eerily similar thing to what happened to Barack Obama in 2013, that there's a chemical attack. And back then, Trump said, absolutely do not do anything. America first. And going, when it's his turn, he intervenes.
Yeah, I mean, going back to President John Adams, Adams said famously, and I think my paraphrase is pretty close here, we are friends of liberty everywhere, but we are defenders only of our own. And so that was basically don't roam the world looking for dragons to slay. But that became the internationalism of the U.S. after World War II because, of course, as Wilson found out with the failed League of Nations proposal, we retreated to a kind of isolationism after World War I, and rightly or not, that was seen as what helped lead to World War II and cost us more in terms of blood and treasure. So the idea after World War II was that, no, we are friends of liberty anywhere, and a violation of liberty anywhere does have some impact on us. That's your general neoconservative argument right now. But Trump's position, which is more of the old right, the Pat Buchanan right, as well as the Breitbart and alt-right now, is more of that retreat to saying, no, we're going to take care of ourselves. The rest of you, it's too bad you're on your own. But this strike is what confuses that now, especially among his supporters who expected him not to intervene in things like this.
Dennis Goldford with us of Drake University, as well as Dave Anderson of Iowa State University. Larry joining us now from Coralville. Thanks for listening. Thanks for dialing in. Larry, what's your question?
Well, my question has to do with what you were talking about before with regard to the declaration of war. Several years ago when Mr. Leach was still representing us in Congress, he gave a talk here, and I talked to him after, and I asked him, why don't we just declare war against Iraq when we were going in for the second time? And he said, well, he's reluctant to declare war because that infers to the people that we will fight to the end no matter the amount of death, cost of treasure, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm wondering, is that a feeling in Congress that they are reluctant to sit down and vote yay or nay on a war because that would mean a long, long, long battle?
Interesting observation, Larry. In Coralville, our longest conflict is presently Afghanistan, even longer than Vietnam. Thoughts on this, gentlemen?
Sure. Well, one of the things I don't think a lot of Americans realize is that we've only had five declared wars in our history. We had the the War of 1812, Mexican-American War, Spanish-American War, World War I, and World War II. And they all have similar features in that we knew who the enemy was, and we committed ourselves as a nation to annihilate that enemy. And we told the president, we are going to give you full authority over the military to annihilate our enemy, and then you will bring us to peace by negotiating a treaty. Once Congress declares war, they can't take it back. And that was a system that worked very well, really before World War II, when you had to amass a giant military operation and conquer a foe. But in the modern world, it's a lot trickier than that. Simply defining who the enemy is in Syria is tricky. One of the big divisions between the United States and Russia right now is that we don't agree on who the terrorists in Syria are. It's very hard to say we're going to identify these people and annihilate them, which is why in both Afghanistan and Iraq, we didn't have a declaration of war. We said, well, we're going to authorize the use of military force to achieve certain objectives, but Congress did not want to give a blank check to the president. An authorization for use of military force, Congress can actually repeal that. They still have direct control over funding, and they can cut off funding for military operations, not that they're ever likely to do that. It means that Congress has a lot more oversight. And that's the reality of the world right now, is war is, I wouldn't say an obsolete concept, but it just doesn't fit the definition of what we do militarily anymore.
Hmm. Thank you, Larry in Coralville, for that very interesting question and the very interesting responses we had for that. By the way, this might be a good time for me to jump in and say that we've talked a lot so far this hour about issues facing Congress, and we've been trying to talk with our congressional delegation about these issues as well. Just to let you know, because some of you have gotten in touch with us about this, we've extended invitation to Iowa's entire delegation. We do that all the time. So far, Congressman Steve King and Congressman Dave Loebsack are the only two members to accept our many invitations. We continue to reach out to Senators Ernst, Senator Grassley, as well as Congressman Blum and Young, and we'll continue to try to bring them to these airwaves for a conversation with us, with you, as soon as possible. Just an update on that. Very quickly, before we go to break, the other hotspot in the world, North Korea, pursuing nuclear-tipped missiles that could reach the U.S., a naval carrier strike group near the Korean Peninsula, feeding fears of a military response if North Korea conducts another nuclear test. Thoughts, Dennis, on the approach we're seeing by this president and his options?
Well, you know, the president likes to say he subscribes to the madman theory of international relations. That goes back to Richard Nixon. He thought that if the Soviets and the Chinese way back then were convinced that Nixon would do just about anything at any given moment, it would make them sufficiently nervous about rustling the status quo. Mr. Trump seems to say he likes being unpredictable, and that makes our allies nervous. But if anybody seems to be the madman unpredictable type, it's the leader of North Korea. It's hard to know what he wants to do. Absolutely only power he has other than over North Korea is nuclear weapons. Otherwise, the country is a mess economically. China keeps it afloat. And the danger is if something goes nuclear there, it's Japan and South Korea that would pay the price. So they're very nervous about that. That's just an awful situation. It makes Syria seem like a piece of cake.
Mm, okay. We'll pick up when we continue after a short break. Turning from our look abroad to more domestic issues, the swearing in of Neil Gorsuch to be fill that vacant ninth seat. How many months was that? 14 months it was vacant. Not only how it changes the Supreme Court, but how the U.S. Senate is changing in light of the rule change that led to that confirmation. Remember, we went from 60 to confirm the nominee down to a simple majority, 51. That happened last week. I want to ask our guests, Dave Anderson of Iowa State University and Dennis Goldford of Drake University, how they see the U.S. Senate changing when we come back. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a few minutes with more Politics Wednesday. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday today with Dave Anderson, our political scientist from Iowa State University, political scientist Dennis Goldford of Drake University. We'd like to have you join our conversation as we talk, move into the Supreme Court, how the Senate is changing, also how hard it is to be the White House press spokesperson. We'll talk about that in a few minutes as well. Well, on Monday of this week, Donald Trump enjoyed the biggest political victory of his presidency at the White House, a White House ceremony. His Supreme Court pick, Neil Gorsuch, was sworn in. He was able to fulfill a top campaign promise when the Republican-led Senate voted to confirm the conservative judge to a lifetime job. That was last Friday, despite all the Democratic opposition. We remember Gorsuch filling a vacancy that lingered for 14 months after the conservative Justice Antonin Scalia died in February of 2016. Trump made the point of thanking the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell for his role in winning the confirmation. McConnell last week led that effort to change the longstanding Senate rules in order to end a Democratic filibuster of Gorsuch's nomination. We remember that it was under McConnell's leadership that the Senate last year refused to consider Barack Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland to replace Scalia. Let's listen to the newest member of the Supreme Court, Judge Justice Neil Gorsuch, sworn in as Associate Justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. Here he is at a Rose Garden ceremony on Monday, speaking to the crowd after taking the oath.
And to the American people, I am humbled by the trust placed in me today. I will never forget that to whom much is given, much will be expected. And I promise you that I will do all my powers permit to be a faithful servant of the Constitution and laws of this great nation. Thank you.
Justice Neil Gorsuch, before we get to the question of how the Senate is changing with that rule change, Dennis, tell us about the immediate impact on the Supreme Court now with this conservative ninth judge added to the bench.
Well, prior to the death of Justice Scalia, roughly speaking, you had a court divided into four, relatively, depending upon the issue, but for the most part, four relatively reliable conservative votes, which would be Alito, Thomas, Roberts, and who am I missing, Dave?
Scalia.
Yeah, including Scalia, certainly, yes. And on the other side, four relatively reliable, more liberal votes, Sotomayor, Kagan, Ginsburg, and Breyer, and Justice Kennedy, who was appointed by President Reagan after a botched nomination or two in the around 1987 or so. He basically swung the court one way or the other. And with the loss of Scalia, that made it basically four more conservative justices, four more liberal justices. And in case of a 4-4 tie, what the court does is affirm the lower court ruling, although that itself doesn't count as a precedent. So with the appointment of Justice Gorsuch, that returns us, as it were, to the status quo ante. It returns us to a situation where you have five relatively reliable four relatively reliable conservatives and four relatively reliable liberals, and again, Justice Kennedy in there as a possible tiebreaker. Some people have argued that Justice Gorsuch in certain areas is, in fact, even more conservative than Justice Scalia, but that remains to be seen. But the appointment doesn't change the overall character of the court. If, in fact, President Trump gets an appointment due to the retirement of Justice Kennedy, or especially, say, Justice Ginsburg or Justice Breyer, that really it becomes nuclear, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. So these key issues that we look to the Supreme Court for the last word on, gun control, abortion, the death penalty, presidential powers, the religious rights, for instance, Dave, you agree that's really not changing at this point. It would be when another Supreme Court justice bows out?
Yes. I think we're returning to kind of the status quo. There's been a conservative majority on the Supreme Court now since the 1970s, and it's going to continue for the foreseeable future. Mm-hmm. Trump may really be able to influence the court, and especially if he gets to replace Justice Ginsburg, we'll see the court become more conservative than it has been in a very long time.
Let's switch our focus to the Senate and how it's been changed by last week's events. The swearing in of Gorsuch marks an end of a contentious debate over his confirmation, changing the rules of the U.S. Senate. As Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell invoked the so-called nuclear option, namely requiring only a simple majority vote to approve that nomination, Minority Leader Democrat Chuck Schumer warned of dire consequences.
We have a more conservative Supreme Court than we've had in a very long time. Nothing, not even the rules, not even the comity of the Senate, seems to stop them. When the dust settles, make no mistake about it, it will have been the Republicans who changed the rules on the Supreme Court. But we take no solace that history will put it on their shoulders, because the consequences for the Senate and for the future of the Supreme Court will be far-reaching. The nuclear option means the end of a long history of consensus on Supreme Court nominations. It weakens the standing of the Senate as a whole, as a check on the president's ability to shape the judiciary. In a post-nuclear world, if the Senate and the presidency are in the hands of the same party, there's no incentive to even speak to the Senate minority. That's a recipe for more conflict and bad blood between the parties, not less.
Senator Schumer not mentioning that this latest step by the Republicans comes after several years after Democrats, who were What frustrated at not being to approve judges of their own, lower court judges, changed the rules on Republicans. So, Dave, let me start with you looking at the bigger picture. How does this latest rule change for the SCOTUS nominees, change the Senate as a body of government?
It is surprisingly important to see this filibuster power rolled back. Most people know that the Congress is separated into the House and the Senate, but the difference between those two bodies is just enormous. And it is not because they're given different powers. It's because of the different procedures within each chamber and how they choose to act. For a very long time, the Senate has been more deliberative and has given more individual power to senators. And this has made them work together collaboratively and have to cooperate. And largely this is because senators have had the ability to filibuster very important things like judicial appointments. When that's gone, it means that the Senate is going to start acting more like the House of Representatives. And the House is defined by majority party rule. Whatever the majority party wants to do, all they have to do is hold the party together and they get what they want. This change means that the only filibuster power remaining in the Senate is for legislation, which is probably the more important of the filibuster powers. But I think everybody would agree that the days of the filibuster in the Senate are numbered now. We've been whittling away at it for a while. And when the legislative filibuster is finally removed, which I'm going to predict it's probably going to happen in the next decade.
Really?
I think it's gone because the Senate no longer has an incentive to be a place of comity and of bipartisanship and of senators working together.
Interesting you say that, Dave, because both the Democratic leadership and the Republican leadership at this point, of course, we know that can change, say they would definitely not support any sort of rule change for filibustering legislation. But who knows? Dennis, looking back at our Constitution, the Senate, the U.S. Senate, the House were supposed to act in different ways. Does this break down that and we get them kind of two bodies that are more and more similar?
That, of course, what Dave was saying. I mean, I remember when James Madison said to me at the Constitutional Convention, he said, look, you know, of the various, if you talk about four, in effect, branches of American government as set out, initially only one was directly accountable to the people. And, of course, the people then meant white male property holders. And that was the House of Representatives. The president was not and is still not directly elected by the people, ask Hillary Clinton or Al Gore. The federal judges, the courts, are not elected at all, electorally accountable to the people. And the Senate initially, was picked by the state legislatures, and that was changed by the 17th Amendment, which passed in 1913. So we have direct popular election of the senators now. So that made, in one level, the senators more like the House. But the Senate always adopted, as Dave mentioned, this rule of the filibuster to give the minority a chance to have some breathing room and have some impact. The House is purely a majoritarian institution. It's the way it is in a parliamentary system. If you're not a member of the majority, you're in deep trouble in the House. There's not much you can do except to say, remember, we will be in power again at some point and we have long memories. But in the Senate, the idea was that you, through the filibuster, through requiring a supermajority to get something done, you needed to consult others and find some consensus. The problem was, of course, they changed the nature of what you needed for a filibuster and breaking a filibuster because of Southern opposition to civil rights legislation in the late 1950s and early 1960s under JFK. But what you've had is the parties become more national in scope. They're concerned more about their national majorities. And so you get what Dave said. You've got a situation in which the Senate can begin to look more like the House, which means that if you're in the minority in the Senate, you just don't have the leverage you used to have.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, do you also believe, like Dave said, that the days of filibustering legislation, those days are numbered for the Senate now, the next step?
Oh, I'd say there's at least a 50-50 chance for that because, I mean, see, all senators want the filibuster when it serves their own purposes. I mean, part of the problem for Democrats in the early Obama years is the Republicans used the filibuster almost to prevent Obama from staffing his own administration. So they arguably misused the filibuster in that regard, and that's why the Democrats got rid of it for cabinet appointees and regular federal lower court federal judges. But they kept it for the Supreme Court. And now all of a sudden the Democrats want it back again. Well, the Republicans were just on the opposite side of that. So, you know, it's there's that old line, where you stand is based upon where you sit. In other words, what your principles are depend upon what your interests are.
Dennis Goldford with us of Drake University. Dave Anderson with us of Iowa State University, finishing up in the next 10 minutes our Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Let's talk about the difficulty, the challenges of being a White House press secretary. I don't know about you gentlemen, but I would not want that
worst job in America.
Worst job in America. Let's listen to evidence of that. Well, from this particular White House press secretary in a briefing on Tuesday, Sean Spicer, the White House press secretary, was asked about why Russia, who has been allied with Syria for decades, would abandon that alliance and Syrian President Bashar al-Assad over the use of chemical weapons. And this is what he said.
You look, we didn't use chemical weapons in World War II. You know, you had a, you know, someone as despicable as Hitler who didn't even sink to using chemical weapons. So you have to, if you're Russia, ask yourself, is this a country that you and a regime that you want to align yourself with? You have previously signed on to international agreements, rightfully acknowledging that the use of chemical weapons should be out of bounds by every country. To not stand up to not only Assad, but your own word should be troubling. This is Russia put their name on the line. So it's not a question of how long that alliance has lasted, but at what point do they recognize that they are now getting on the wrong side of history in a really bad way, really quickly? And again, look at the countries that are standing with them. Iran, Syria, North Korea. This is not a team you want to be on. And I think that Russia has to recognize that while they may have had an alliance for them, that the lines that have been crossed are ones that no country should ever want to see another country cross.
To clarify something you said that seems to be gaining some traction right now. Quote, Hitler didn't even sink to the level of using chemical weapons. What did you mean by that?
I think when you come to sarin gas, he was not using the gas on his own people the same way that Assad is doing. I mean, there was clearly, I understand your point. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. There was not he brought him into the, to the Holocaust Center. I understand that. But I'm saying in the way that Assad used them, where he went into towns, dropped them down to innocent into the middle of towns, it was brought to it. So the use of it, and I appreciate the clarification there. That was not the intent.
Later on CNN, John Spicer apologized for those remarks.
It was insensitive and inappropriate. So I'm not looking to quantify this in any way. It was an attempt to talk about, I should have stayed focused on the Assad regime and the dangers that they have brought to their own people and the terrible atrocities they did, and to drag any other comparison into this was not appropriate.
Dennis Goldford, your reaction to this gaffe and the huge amount of attention the media has heaped on it.
I'm not a Twitter person, but OMG, how's that? I think, look, the general rule is you never want to use a sentence or be part of a sentence that has the name Hitler in it, because you're just going to get into trouble. And more specifically, the historical ignorance of Spicer was just astounding, which is what set everybody off. And then finally, his premise bought into the Hitler premise. In other words, when he said he didn't use this gas, and of course, you know, I've visited Dachau. I've walked into the gas chamber and the crematorium. I've seen how this works there on the ground, because they have a memorial set up. And so they used a cyanide capsule that was dropped out of a shower, and then as it hit the floor, it broke, and a gas came out of it, and that's what killed people. And when Spicer said he didn't use this against his own people, Hitler's whole point was that German Jews are not truly German. They're an alien being, alien body. So Spicer was buying into the Hitler premise, which is what set people of all faiths off all across the world when he said that. So the historical ignorance was just astounding. The problem is, that Mr. Trump doesn't have a lot more historical knowledge in this regard or in these sorts of things than Spicer does. So at one level, Spicer's the perfect press secretary for President Trump because, again, it's a lack of basic historical knowledge that gets everybody into trouble.
Dave, your reaction, and is this reason enough to fire Sean Spicer as, well, Nancy Pelosi, of course, from the opposing party is calling for?
I would say no. It's a horrible gaffe. If this was the only gaffe, I think it would actually get more attention. It's just kind of a part of a long-running story right now that press conferences out of the White House almost on a daily basis have either factual inaccuracies, are misleading, have atrocious gaffes like this. And I know a lot of people are calling for Sean Spicer to be removed from his position, but I'm not sure who else in America wants it. And I will somewhat defend him on having the worst position in America because his job is to stand in front of the press corps every day and try to articulate a coherent message out of the White House. And right now, the White House is still struggling to put together a coherent message and to put together a coherent set of policies. And what I think happens is Sean Spicer has to guess at how his remarks are going to be attacked by the press, or just the press is going to seek clarification from him. Mm-hmm. And there are so many questions about what the White House is doing right now. I don't think he can anticipate. Mm-hmm. And he winds up doing what he did yesterday, which is freewheeling off the top of his head, that any media relations person will tell you, don't ever do that. Never reference Hitler. You're never going to win that conversation. I think Sean Spicer is just in way over his head right now, but I think anybody would be in this position.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but the thing pointed out was that the Sean Spicer did something yesterday that perhaps has not happened in this White House, an apology for anything.
Yes, that was a welcome change to simply admit that you made a mistake. And yes, mistakes are going to happen, especially if you're doing frequent press briefings. You're going to get things wrong. You're going to ad lib and say things you shouldn't say. And it's kind of refreshing to see him apologize. It's just a little too late.
Mm-hmm. We have just a few minutes left, so this is going to be a quick wrap up here. The first 100 days of this administration approaching that benchmark that we always use, a symbolic benchmark, I think coming up April 29th. Reflections on successes, failures so far of this administration. I'm particularly interested in your thoughts on the effectiveness of these three rival power centers that Donald Trump has installed. We have Reince Priebus, the chief of staff, the son-in-law Jared Kushner, and the chief strategist Steve Bannon. Dennis, you want to go first? I have about a minute for each of you.
Sure. With regard to that, I mean, Mr. Trump supposedly enjoys management by chaos. He likes setting up rival power centers and just sees what happens and supposedly works very profitably and fruitfully on that basis. That may well have worked in business, private business for him. There's a serious question as to whether that works when you're the head of government. The assumption is that government should be run by a business, but most people will tell you that the government is categorically different from a business. What works in one may not work in the other. The 100 days is a metric or a benchmark, as you say, that goes back to Franklin Roosevelt, the flurry of activity that he engaged in his first 3.5 months roughly in office during the Depression, trying this, trying that. And so it becomes artificial in a way. But the president got Gorsuch confirmed. But he hasn't gotten a lot else done at this point because, I mean, he'll claim that he created 600,000 jobs in the first couple of months. Most people say it's nowhere near that. But if that's the benchmark, it's a fairly thin record at this point.
Okay. Dave, you have the last word today.
I think the only way that the 100 days can be looked at is as disappointing so far. Trump had very clear goals that he set during the campaign, things he said he was going to do. And he hasn't accomplished anything yet. And in light of the fact that his party has a majority in the Senate and in the House, it's really hard to look at this administration and say that there's a lot to be very proud of. It's still early in his administration. There's still plenty of time for him to accomplish his goals. But the 100-day metric, I think it's hard to figure out how you could say it's a passing grade.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much for your expertise this hour. Dave Anderson, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Dennis Goldford, professor and chair of political science at Drake University. To be continued, these exciting political times. We're glad you're on board to interpret the times and the actions, the events for us. Dennis and Dave, we appreciate you coming into our studios today. Thank you.
For having us.
Always a pleasure.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Lindsay Moon. Help from Chelsea Hoy. Today, our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.